Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, April 21st, 2022. We have five cases on our calendar for today. This one is the second of three oral arguments that we will be hearing. This is case number A21-1316, In re the estate of Bernie Carl Payne, deceased. Counsel, we are holding these oral arguments via zoom.gov. We are recording these proceedings. No other recordings, however, are permitted under statute. We will be, or under rules, I should say, we will be having 15 minutes for appellant's initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes for respondent, and then 5 minutes by appellant on rebuttal, if you so choose. We appreciate all of you joining us by Zoom. We do realize that on occasion, parties may or the court may run into some technical difficulties. If we do, we will certainly make sure that we pause the proceedings and allow each of the parties the proper amount of time to get back to readjust and restart their arguments. So with that, counsel for appellant, if you can state your name for the record, the party you are representing, you may proceed. And please note there's a clock there as well, so you can keep track of how much time you have.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. My name is Noble Simpson, and I'm the attorney for appellant Jolinda Ellotson in this matter. I always prefer a dialogue over a forced march through an outline of arguments I know you've already read. So please, if you have any questions, do not hesitate to interrupt me. In this matter, the decedent's will contains directions regarding disposition of his real property. It establishes a condition for Tobin Payne to purchase the property at a substantial discount. The district court erred by disregarding this condition and allowing Tobin Payne to purchase the property at the discounted rate past his deadline to do so. The basis of the district court's decision was its conclusion that the will contains a latent ambiguity. And based on this conclusion, the district court admitted extrinsic evidence regarding the testator's intent of this deadline. The district court also speculated what the decedent would have done with knowledge of events after his death and rewrote his will based on this speculation. Because of these errors, this court should reverse the district court's order. The deadline in the will is mandatory. The testator's 180-day deadline cannot be brushed aside as a merely precatory expression of his wishes. Shall is directive. The will was drafted by an attorney. That attorney would have known that shall would be construed as mandatory, not merely precatory. A district court may not simply set aside mandatory conditional language in a will. A district court,
if I may,
of course,
Mr. Simpson, I'm taking advantage of you. Said interrupt. Don't put you on a forced march. So one of my questions is, looking at that language, what about this phrase, in the event he cannot close the purchase? One question that came to my mind, and I think was raised by respondent to the district court, at least below, the district court didn't follow this in his order or her order. He cannot close a purchase. What does that mean? Does it mean he cannot close the purchase financially, or does it just mean, because cannot is different than he does not close the purchase, right? If it was he does not close the purchase, I'd think, well, that seems a lot clearer. That's crystal clear. But cannot, doesn't that introduce some ambiguity, which then would allow the court to go to extrinsic evidence?
On the facts of this case, it does not, Your Honor. Tobin Payne argued both at the district court and I believe on appeal that he was ready, willing, and able financially to make the purchase. And he simply did not avail himself of the procedures that he could have used to make the purchase. So he was able. He could have purchased the property within the deadline. He simply sat on his hands and did not do so. For example, there
Mr. Simpson, if I may, I think what you're arguing, though, is how the terms of the will apply in his particular situation. And my understanding of how the district court looked at it is that the facts actually revealed a latent ambiguity. There's at least more than one reasonable ways of interpreting that phrase in the event he cannot close a purchase. And one would be that it could be referring to whether or not he has a financial capacity as to one. And then the second as to whether or not he could actually close the transaction, the purchase within the 180 days. And because there are two ways to interpret it, two reasonable ways to interpret it, that language is ambiguous. And if it's ambiguous, then the court can look to extrinsic evidence. But if it's unambiguous, then you have to just rely on the plain language of it.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. So responding to both your comment and then following on Judge Jessen's comment, for a patent ambiguity, the court looks at just the language itself within the will and the legal framework in which that will would have to attempt to operate. And if the will is internally consistent and it could operate in that legal system, there's no patent ambiguity. And here the parties and the district court agreed that there was no patent ambiguity.
Well, I'm not so, Mr. Simpson, I'm not so sure that the district court agreed on that. The district court explicitly found that there was a latent ambiguity, but I don't recall the district court explicitly saying there is no patent ambiguity.
And that's correct, Your Honor. The parties had agreed in their district court briefing that there was no patent ambiguity, and the district court order is silent on the question. So if it's at least constructively not finding a patent ambiguity. It wasn't in dispute, and the court did not pass on it. So it's not an issue on appeal. It's not an issue the parties have raised on appeal. With regard to your comment, Your Honor, then the process, if there's no patent ambiguity, is then the court, to determine whether there's a latent ambiguity, looks at the facts and circumstances surrounding the will. Not extrinsic evidence, just the facts and circumstances. So a will generally has two lists. It has a list of people, entities, trustee, and it has a list of property. And to determine whether there's a latent ambiguity, the court or the personal representative first looks at the list of people and entities in the will and then looks out in the world just far enough to see if there's a match. Can I understand this will based on this list and what I can find out in the world? Or can it not operate? Is there a contradiction? Same thing for the property. Often cars get sold, property gets foreclosed on, jewelry gets gifted away. So the question is, I have this list of property in the will. Can I match this property with the surrounding facts and circumstances out in the world? And if I find a match on all cases, no latent ambiguity. So if there's a contradiction, then I get to look at extrinsic evidence.
Mr. Simpson, why isn't the unexpected pandemic, which was one of the two reasons that the district court found a latent ambiguity, why isn't that like the unexpected change in the marital deduction in estate of Aaron?
The unexpected change in the marital deduction was a legal change. And so that goes to a patent ambiguity. You look at the will itself, the legal framework in which it would have to operate, knowing the rules, knowing the law, looking at the will. And it couldn't work the way it was intended to work. A latent ambiguity doesn't go to law, it goes to facts. Can I match the people and property in this will to the people and property that I can find out in the world? And if I can't, I get to look at extrinsic evidence. Here, the pandemic is different because a proceeding can be delayed for any number of reasons. The court calendar, scheduling conflicts, natural disasters, all the reasons that anything can be delayed in a court proceeding. And the laws for what you do in response to those delays haven't changed. You can still have a special administration. You can still have an emergency special administration without notice and hearing, simply decided on the written papers. You can still request a tolling order. none of this has changed. There have been no relevant legal changes since the time the will was drafted and the time the probate proceeding was opened.
Then, Mr. Simpson, may I go back and ask you a question about something you said earlier? I believe you said that before the district court, the parties agreed that there wasn't a patent ambiguity. I'm looking at the memorandum of law in support of the petition for an order approving sale of the property, where I see a section that says the decedent's will contains a patent ambiguity. Was that later retracted at some point? I mean, you know this record better than I do. Did the parties agree? No, we're just talking about a latent ambiguity. So that's my first question. And my second question, which I'd like both of you to comment on, should we be looking at this in terms of latent and patent ambiguities in the first place? I was reading, like, I think it was In re Cole or that case, which really called into question about whether we should be, no, it was back in 2001, talking about ambiguities in this construct.
My first answer to your question, Your Honor, is no, that's my error. If there was an allegation of patent ambiguity, but it was not passed on by the district court and it has not been raised on appeal. And second, although academically the distinction remains between patent and latent ambiguities, what's admissible is now the same under Cole. So the court can look at the surrounding facts and circumstances, regardless of whether it finds or is examining to determine whether there is a patent or latent ambiguity, and can resolve those by looking at the surrounding facts and circumstances. And when an ambiguity is found, that's when the court can then look at extrinsic evidence regarding the settlor's intent. So the distinction remains, but the procedure following that distinction is now merged, so to speak.
Mr. Simpson, when I look at the district court order, the district court specifically found that the delay past the 180 days in the will was not due to any fault of the personal representative, and focused on, in particular, the pandemic, but also the objections. Why isn't that relative to the analysis of making sure that the testator's intent is followed through?
So the objections are not unforeseeable. Objections have been allowed in probate proceedings for as long as there have been probate proceedings. The appellant was certainly within her rights and reason to object to the respondent's appointment as personal representative because of what she alleged he had been doing and with their parents' tangible personal property and disposing of that without notice to her. She objected to his appointment as personal representative. At the time, she did not object to him enforcing the will. In fact, there's uncontroverted testimony in the trial transcript that she was the one who reminded him of his deadline. Even though he had been on constructive notice for 3.5 years, she actually reminded him of it and even put in a bid on the property before her window of time to do so that would go into effect as of December 26th, 2021, when her window of time to bid on the property opened. So she was attempting to enforce this provision of the will and was actively notifying respondent of it. He simply sat on his rights.
He hadn't been appointed as a personal representative. How can the personal representative dispose of the property when there is no personal representative in the position in the first place? That's my first question. The second question I have is that there was supposed to be, there was a hearing that was held, I believe it was November 10th of 2020, And that hearing, they didn't have enough time to hear objections, and so it was continued to February 8th, which was past the deadline for the 180 days. And the district court specifically noted that that was the earliest that it could have gotten on the calendar. My point to that is, with the pandemic, it delayed everything. It really kind of threw a wrench into all the proceedings and all the hearings. And so the district court, and at that February 8th hearing, She didn't even appear. And that's when the district court did appoint the PR. But the district court seems to be kind of taking a more or less a common sense approach of everything was delayed. All the proceedings were basically put on hold due to the pandemic. And so the district court seems to be saying, I'm not going to fault the personal representative when they weren't in the position to do anything until appointed on February 8th. Why is that against logic?
Because, Your Honor, we have to maintain a distinction between Tobin Payne in his capacity as nominated personal representative or personal representative and Tobin Payne individually. The devise under the will is to Tobin Payne individually, right? So if let's say one of the other siblings had been the personal representative, he would have been proceeding in the district court proceeding as an interested person, not as the personal representative or nominated personal representative, but individually to exercise this option. And he did not request a tolling order. He did not request a stipulation from the other parties that his deadline could be tolled. He simply made no effort, did not raise the issue, sat on his hands and watched his deadline go by. And there's nothing inequitable in enforcing a will under those circumstances where a devisee has not exercised or preserved his right to a devise. Thank you, Your Honor. I see my time has lapsed.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I will now turn to attorney for respondent. If you will have 15 minutes for your arguments, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jacob Erickson, E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N, and I'm the attorney representing the respondents. I'd say there's two in this case, Tobin Payne as the personal representative and Tobin Payne in his individual capacity. Frankly, this is a case where the respondents properly followed statutes and procedures, and appellants are seeking to punish them by twisting the facts, twisting the arguments, and attempting to create complications where none exists. In fact, appellants have attempted to do that at every stage of this proceeding.
Well, Mr. Erickson, I'm not sure if appellants are necessarily twisting the facts. I think they're just looking at taking a literal reading of the will and saying it says 100 days, it shall purchase within 180 days. It didn't happen. So Mr. Payne is out. I'm not sure that's twisting the facts. I think it's just taking a literal reading of the will and the particular facts here.
Your Honor, and I would certainly apologize for any offense. I certainly didn't mean to cause any. I think the issue here really comes to the fact that appellants want the court to simply focus on that one sentence and ignore everything else. Even in the Ordeen's will, they seem to cut out the requirement that, well, the express language of the will be used. It's only used if it's not inconsistent with the other rules of law. And that's really what we get to when we look at the court's order. And I think it's also misconstruing the court's order to suggest that the entire order is based on the concept of an ambiguity, whether it's patent or latent. Because if you look at paragraph 4 of the order, after the court has said, I find that there's this ambiguity, and so I can look at this other information, the court specifically cites the Yates case to say that even if there was no ambiguity, the evidence of the surrounding circumstances is still admissible to determine the testator's intent, and then goes down in paragraph 5 to say, an examination of the surrounding circumstances indicates that the decedent in this case never intended to prevent Tobin Payne from being able to purchase the property or the personal representative from being able to sell the property based on the delay in the appointment of the personal representative. And that's, Your Honor, really why I got at that Hensky case. Even though it's a real estate case, it is what appellants are trying to do here. In Hensky, the court said that the contention of stopping the sale is without merit in a suit to try to keep the vendee from being able to purchase if the vendor is setting up as a defense their own failure or neglect. And that's really what it is appellants are trying to do here. Mr. Payne would have been appointed as the personal representative in November, and there would have been no problems going forward, but for the fact that they chose to object. And because of the pandemic and because of the extreme court delays, that hearing was set out until February after that deadline. What appellant attempted to do was set up a situation where the vendor was unavailable and then are attempting to punish the vendee for the lack of a vendor. And the court found that that's against the interests of the decedent. That's not what was intended in looking at the will, whether we look at an ambiguity or not. It simply was inappropriate. So reading the will, looking at what's in there, and looking at the surrounding law, the court came to the correct decision, and that's why we're asking the court to simply affirm the district court.
Erickson, if I may, you know, in looking at that, maybe I'm mispronouncing the case, Aaron case, I can see how an unexpected pandemic could fit in, would be like the unexpected change in the marital deduction law. Mm-hmm. Much harder for me to see how that applies to objections to a personal representative. You know, I mean, why, you know, you have what, five siblings here, four or five? That just strikes me as something that should be, you know, expected, or at least far on the continuum when you look at unexpected items versus a change in the law or a pandemic.
And there's a lot of really good questions there. I'm going to try to break them into multiple ones, and hopefully I can kind of get at all of them. And if I miss one, please let me know, because I want to make sure I answer them. First, kind of going at the expectations. I think a change in the law is more expected, because we expect that every year the legislature will go back and could make changes, could modify rules. That's something that we know is going to happen. But a world-changing pandemic where suddenly everybody's life is upended and we're trapped in our homes and we can't do things. I mean, this has constantly been referred to as unprecedented times. We've had to take unprecedented actions. For example, right now, I'm not standing before you in front of a lectern, which is what we've always done at the Court of Appeals in St. Paul. I'm in my office and we're all in different locations. I don't know that anyone could look into the future having expected this. As for whether or not the objection to a personal representative would count as some kind of an unforeseen circumstance, I don't think that that necessarily goes into the question of whether or not there's an ambiguity. That just goes into what the court found under the Yates case, of even if there wasn't an ambiguity, still looking at the surrounding circumstances, what was the intent? And the court found that Vernie Payne's clear intent was to offer this property for sale to Tobin at this amount. And to allow somebody to get in and block that by preventing a personal representative from existing, that goes into that Henschke case of saying you can't make the vendor unavailable and then say, okay, Bendy, you've now forfeited your right. So I don't think that that portion would apply to the ambiguity question. It would apply to, you know, if the ambiguity didn't necessarily exist, did the court still come to a proper ruling? Because the court is making a decision at different levels here. If I look at this as ambiguity, I find that there's the appropriate means to go forward, and this is the right thing for me to do. And gosh, even if there wasn't any ambiguity, I'm still doing the right thing, because looking at the statutes, this is what I'm supposed to do to determine the testator's intent. And the problem with appellant's argument is that they keep leaving off of the cases that identify interpretation of the will, that the will has to be interpreted in relation to the existing rules of law, and that it can't be repugnant to well-settled principles of public policy. And that's why I kind of launched into that second section that they're saying is new. I don't think that it is new under the Henschke case, because what I'm saying is, even if they're technically correct, there's no harm to them, because there's still this requirement to comply with the statute, because the will constitutes a contract for the sale of real estate under the TNT case.
And but you did. But they're right. You didn't argue that to the district court. Correct, that statute, particular statute.
I'm actually taking over for the attorney that did it before. But yes, I would have argued that the respondents didn't go into that because they didn't need to. They had a different issue that they raised, and they went forward with it. And I don't know that that would have even been ripe, because that action would be the problem we have of appellants lumping Tobin Payne into one person. Tobin Payne, acting as the personal representative, has been moving through to do what he's supposed to do as the PR, trying to get appointed, once appointed, trying to carry out the intent of the will and move forward. If for some reason this was to be reversed, Tobin Payne, the individual, would still have the right to come in and say, look, this is a contract that I have the right to enforce. You haven't done what you need to do to get rid of my interest, and so I would just be proceeding forward. And that's why my argument is, even if they could prove some minor technical error, they're still not entitled to reversal. It should still be affirmed.
So, taking a big step back, Mr. Erickson, you know, as a judge on the Court of Appeals, I'm often called to interpret statutes and rules, right? Mm-hmm. And we know, we look at the plain language of the rule, and if, you know, and if it's plain, then we kind of can look at the other rules around it and some other things. Then that's what we go with. We don't look at what did the legislature intend. Reading some of the cases and hearing you, you're saying, but that's not the way we look at wills. We should more quickly, I hear you saying, go to what did the decedent intend more quickly than we would in a statutory interpretation analysis. Am I hearing you correctly?
I think what I would say I'm arguing is that the district court properly identified the intent of the testator by looking at the will, the language, and reasonably the evidence of the surrounding circumstances, whether there's an ambiguity or not, to come to a well-reasoned decision.
And I'm just saying, that's different than what we would do looking at a statute.
Yes. Right?
The reason I'm trying to have this higher level discussion with you is because I'm trying to say, what is the case that just best describes what, I mean, I've kind of gleaned that, reading some of the cases, and there's some language, and they talk about this tension between let's apply what the will says versus do we look at the intent? And what would be the best place for a Minnesota precedent that would help us look at your point, which seems to be you can more quickly look at intent here than you could in statutory interpretation?
I guess I'd have to defer to Judge Tenney. I think he's smarter than I am, and so I'd go to that Yates case. That's what the court is supposed to do, whether there's an ambiguity or not. And here, the court isn't finding any ambiguity. And to be honest, I think there's a problem with appellant's position because they keep harping on, Tobin was allowed to buy this property at a substantial discount because he got it for $160,000, and now we can show that it's worth more. Well, that in and of itself is raising an ambiguity based on the language alone. Was it intended to be a discount, or was it intended to be fair market value? I mean, certainly he could have said, can purchase at fair market value if that was his intent, but he put a dollar value in there. And what was the intent of the decedent at the time that they issued the will as far as that $160,000? Did they think that that was fair value? Did they think that it was low? We don't know. Well, that's an ambiguity right there just on the basis that would allow the court to go forward and make these determinations. In addition, if we're going to look at the will and strictly construe the words, I think that Your Honor brought up an excellent point. It said that it goes to auction if Tobin Payne as the individual cannot close. The court specifically found, and there's basis for that, so it's something that should be deferred to, that he could. He can close. The only thing preventing him from closing was that there wasn't a personal representative at the time to sign the deed. And even if he had brought this motion under section 2524.3-105, there's no reason to believe that that hearing would have been held any sooner or that it would have necessarily made any difference. There simply wasn't a vendor in place to sign the deed.
Mr. Erickson, I have a question along those lines, and that is, why didn't Mr. Payne, for instance, at the November hearing or shortly thereafter, ask that the 180-day deadline in the will be told? Because seeing the writing on the wall, if the next hearing is going to be in February of the next year, that's going to be past the deadline. Why wasn't there any action taken by Mr. Payne at that time?
But I think likely because it was already believed the action had been taken. The steps were taken. They were moving into the court. We had gone in there, and I don't believe that there was any expectation that there would have been any different tolling other than the tolling of filing the formal probate and making the request. And it doesn't make sense for him to file multiple claims when he's moving forward with what he believes should be done. And the case law would support that position because that's what the TNT case holds, that while you're in place and while the matter is in front of the court while it's being decided, that kind of puts a freeze on things because otherwise our courts really wouldn't be able to function. I mean, we can never hope to get things done in the court system as fast as we would otherwise like. So we come to the courts to get that final ruling and that final decision. So I suspect that the attorney at the time simply didn't feel it was necessary because they believed that they had already done that. And the statute cited by appellants really doesn't indicate that it does anything different to toll it. It just gives an option to sell the property in a different way, but would still indicate a personal representative. So what difference would it make? That doesn't toll the 180 days. Either way, it's still bringing it to court and waiting for the court to make a decision.
I want to go to another issue that you raised, Mr. Erickson. I want to try to get clarification on it. I think you had pointed to another part of the will, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I've got the will up in front of me. I think you were referring to actually section one, paragraph one, that starts out and says, quote, as soon after my death as my personal representative deems advisable, and list all the various tasks that the PR can perform. Is your argument on that in essence is like a conditioned precedent? Before anything can be done, you have to have a personal representative in place to take action under the will. I'm just trying to understand what you had a brief reference to that. So trying to get clarification on that.
Honestly, I believe that you phrased it better than I did. But yes, absolutely. Everything is really contingent on getting a personal representative appointed, because nothing can really be done until that PR is in place. And that's under the language of the will itself. And that's exactly what happened here. As soon as Tobin Payne, the PR, was appointed, he immediately took the next statutorily required move under 524.3-713 to get the sale approved, which he was required to do. So in order to actually effectuate the will, there was still a requirement to go to court, because he was doing the self-dealing act that needed really to have the approval of the court. So yes, Your Honor is absolutely correct.
Okay, thank you.
If there's any other questions, I'll certainly take them. Otherwise, I would love to just get the court a little bit more on time. I know you're pressed. So I'll waive my time.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Erickson. Mr. Simpson, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and we will have the clock ready to go, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize if I talk quickly. That's a lot to respond to. First, we absolutely encourage the court to read the will, not only this provision, which provides specifically, purchase closing shall be completed within 180 days of my death, not 180 days of appointment of a personal representative, not 180 days of opening of a probate, 180 days of my death. But we also encourage the court to look at the will as a whole. Look at the other provisions, look at how the will consistently uses the word shall, use the same canons of statutory construction to apply to this will that the court would use in construing a statute or construing a contract. The process should be similar, if not the same, when the court just has a document that it needs to construe. And starting with the plain language, please look at the word shall and the specifics of this provision. This will is absolutely consistent with the rules of law. Now, the court procedures are exist in a context in which this is not unprecedented. The United States has gone through a pandemic before in 1918, and that's not news. So these procedures can exist in the context of a pandemic because it's not unprecedented. We often get orders without hearings. We get orders by stipulation. A special administration can be in an emergency process and done without hearing. We get default hearings if the court simply wants there to be an objection of a window of time for anyone to object, and then can issue the order following a default hearing. The fact that the court was unable to schedule an in-person or virtual hearing, like an actual arguments hearing or evidentiary hearing, is irrelevant. There are other procedures that exist in the context of pandemics that the respondent simply did not avail himself of.
The district court specifically had a rule make a decision as to who the personal representative would be, and it was not a straightforward one because it was being challenged. It was challenged in November, and the district court said, I can't hear that issue right now, but the earliest I can hear it is February. Why didn't that effectively toll the whole process? And looking, you mentioned you're looking at the will as a whole, and the very first paragraph seems to indicate that one of the conditions precedent for any action to be taken under the will is that there's a personal representative. You can't have any action taken unless there's somebody that can actually administer the will. So that's really the first step. So why didn't that effectively toll any action or any deadlines under the will?
Because, Your Honor, the special administration statutes exist for exactly this purpose. When a personal representative cannot be appointed for any reason, the court can, even without a hearing, appoint someone to effectuate a specific provision of a will or simply toll the deadline without having to appoint anybody. So the court needs to distinguish appointment of a personal representative and other provisions of a will. Provisions of a will can be given their full force and effect even while who should be the personal representative to fully administer the estate is in dispute.
So let me rephrase it. Didn't the district court effectively say, hey, you know, I couldn't decide this. This wasn't the fault of the personal representative or Mr. Payne. I effectively told that deadline.
The court could have said that, but it did not. And Mr. Payne did not request that or even raise the issue.
Well, the district court didn't explicitly say that, but it seems like the district court effectively did when it said the delay there was not caused by Mr. Payne. If it was something that he did not do, then yeah, it's going to be enforced against him. But this was something that was caused by the pandemic and in turn by the court not being able to decide this issue until February. And until a personal representative is appointed, nothing more is going to be done because that's a key decision that needs to be made, especially when the personal representative is a party to the proceeding as well.
And Your Honor, what was in controversy at the time was appointment of personal representative. Whether or not he could sell this property to himself under the terms of the will was not in controversy, and there's no evidence that it ever would have been. The appellant is the one who has, in fact, been attempting to enforce this provision of the will. And well, I see my time has lapsed, Your Honor.
Judge Reyes?
Yes.
May I ask one additional question?
Yes, please.
So I just want to make sure I understand your position. If we, Mr. Simpson, if we adopt your plain language reading of the will under 4D, then the property that would be sold at public option. Is that correct? In other words, it wouldn't then start the 90 days for the other children, because once again, under your reading, it shall be offered with sale, that time has passed. I just want to make sure I understand your position.
That is our position, Your Honor, and that was conceded at the trial. So that is in the trial transcript.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Any other questions from the panel? Seeing none,